Hello, Sean here. Welcome back to the concluding episode talking about David Lewis Williams and his theory about shamanism and cave art. Last episode, we got to the crux of his theory that image making was not something that had to be invented. It is something that our brains do, but usually in altered states of consciousness. But this episode was probably necessary to really get a more thorough understanding of his theory, as well as looking at some other cool things. Something to mention that ties back to earlier episodes is that Lewis Williams does believe in a transition period of increasing complexity that occurred, at least in like Spain and France, around 40,000 years ago. It's often called like a creative explosion that led to the still awe-inspiring images of Chavez and Lasso and Altamira and all the rest. When we talked about this idea in earlier episodes, we were looking at Michel Lorblanchet, another cave art researcher, and how he had a problem with this because he was like, wait a second, all these European guys think that there was some creative explosion that happened in Europe, in France, in Spain, and that's like what birthed modern humanity. Like, it seemed ethnocentric to him, and he was arguing against it, but Lewis Williams, instead, doesn't think that it has anything to do with, like, a special type of human being around in Paleolithic Europe. He thinks that increased social divisiveness was the cause here, and he's building off the ideas of Max Raphael, that cave art researcher we talked about a while back, episode 3.6, I think, who was in a Nazi concentration camp, then wrote a book on cave art, presaging ideas that would become in vogue across the field a few decades in the future, and then he killed himself in New York City. Raphael's focus on social conflict as a driver of art, which is an oversimplification, but that's another way he may have been ahead of everybody else. So this is an explanation for that creative explosion, or whatever you want to call it, that doesn't rely on people in Paleolithic Western Europe just like being smarter or better at art than all humans elsewhere and before. It's a way to explain the art while still maintaining that ability is a human one, right? Increased social divisiveness just activated something or many things that led to Lasso and Chavez and Altamira and all the rest. Something else to mention is that Lewis Williams's theory is just about the origin of cave art in Europe. This doesn't mean that every single prehistoric image found in a European cave was made due to shamanistic trance or someone else trying to capture their mental imagery. As you can imagine, once the methods for image making were practiced, codified, and probably became increasingly central to life, becoming an inextricable part of their shamanisms, maybe, for one, once all this happened, the cat was out of the bag, the cave lion was out of the bag and onto the wall. Lewis Williams thinks that image making arose from our specific neurophysiology and shamanism, and was very involved with shamanism, but this doesn't mean that every single image was made because of shamanism or involved with it. Like, I think that once the techniques for making images were developed and popularized, the causes for making a particular image, like, would multiply, right? Like, maybe some images were made just because some person was talking to their friend about an animal they saw yesterday and had never seen anything like before, and they were like, hey, have you ever seen, no, hang on, let me paint this, it might help, you know, that sort of thing. Lewis Williams describes some of the other causes he imagines, saying, quote, once the initial step had been taken, the development of Upper Paleolithic art probably followed three courses. One stream continued to comprise mental imagery fixed while it was being experienced. A second stream derived from recollected mental imagery. After recovering from the experience, people tried to reconstitute their visions by closely examining the surface on which they had floated. They not only looked closely at the rock wall or ceiling, they also felt its contours and protuberances. Sometimes they needed only to add a few lines, perhaps legs and an underbelly, to complete this vision/image that was, for them, inherently in the rock surface. A third stream, derived from contemplation of the graphic products of the first two streams, and the realization that someone who had never experienced an altered state could duplicate them. Many shamans believe that spirit animals, the ones that they see in their visions, also mingle with herds of real animals. There was therefore a link between spirit and real animals, unquote. So it's kind of interesting that that hunting magic hypothesis that was popular in early rock art studies, maybe was kind of grasping towards some sort of truth, but wasn't quite sufficient, or, you know, was working from faulty assumptions. Lewis Williams also analyzes that question that we've run into multiple times, that question that's still hanging in the air. Why make art in this very deep, dark, and dangerous place? Why doesn't just the mouth of the cave or above ground suffice? Of course, maybe they made images above ground, and those just didn't stick around for tens of thousands of years, but the question remains of why they would go into these deep, dark, often dangerous, especially in the dim lamplight places, right? Even if they made lots of images on the cliffs and rocks above ground, using the bright sunlight, there's still the question of what made them go down into the caves. Clearly daylight and above ground was not sufficient for whatever goals they had. Something made them descend. And Lewis Williams answers by saying that maybe the passage of the cave is connected to that thing we've talked a fair bit about, how a common hallucinatory experience is entering a tunnel or a vortex. The cave is an analogy created by nature of the above ground regular life in the daylight and the tunnel and passage into new worlds. Another interesting suggestion, maybe involved with other suggestions, is that maybe this was a way for everyone to see what the shamans saw in their visions, something that also happened as they dreamt. Like, they used the cave metaphor for the shaman's journey, like how the cave is like a vortex or tunnel the shaman saw, to experience that journey as best as they could. Or maybe some caves were used for some traditional analogs to those vision quest traditions in North America. Maybe all those examples of prehistoric artists using the specific shape of the rock as part of the figure were because they had descended to try to see animals in the rocks. Lewis Williams begins tying all of this together into an as complete as we can hope for description of the cave art of those most well-known sites, and maybe caves elsewhere in the world. He says, quote, "Entry into a cave was, for Upper Paleolithic people, entry into part of the spirit world. The embellishing images blazed, possibly in a fairly literal sense, a path into the unknown," unquote. If these people lost the time conceptualized the universe similar to shamanic societies who have been observed, the cave would have been an entrance to the lower realm, while a higher realm also exists. Or maybe it was conceptualized differently. Maybe it was less about going down than it was about going into a tunnel of vortex, and this was a way to access all spiritual realms. Lewis Williams tries to combine this with what we assume Paleolithic societies were like, and I like many aspects of how he approaches it. He thinks that structuralism went about its explanations in a too rigorous way, kind of like humans are just algorithmically programmed to act in accordance with this so-called structure. Lewis Williams does a good job of balancing between trying to develop a fairly overarching general theory while also keeping the creativity of humans in mind. Like, he talks about shamanisms in Paleolithic Europe, for example. The idea that our shared neurophysiology gives rise to similar things all human cultures have to deal with.
Visions, omens, hallucinations, miracles, ecstasies, dreams, adorations, religions, down on the rocks of time.
But there are still going to be differences between how each culture does this. Each culture is different, each cave is different, each person can see or create in a new way, but also there's something that can be generalized, the field upon which human creativity can play, that's based in our shared neurochemistry, neurophysiology. That's the idea. He says that this lens he's developed should be, quote, "a tool for uncovering diversity, not for concealing it," unquote. I really like that quote. That's a good way to look at things, I think. Lewis Williams takes this lens and applies it in depth to two caves. Two caves in the same region of France, two caves that have art that seems to come from around the same time, but caves with quite different layouts, which he thinks plays a role in the specifics of the art within. Right? Caves are not neutral canvases. It's a very important point. He looks at Gabalu Cave and the famous Lasso Cave. The art in both seems to have been made at the same time in the Magdalenian. In a few episodes, we're going to zoom in on Lasso and do a whole episode, of course, you know, going all over the place, but centered on Lasso. So I'll go over his thoughts to begin that episode. We can see how this lens applies to Lasso. And I do recommend reading about how he goes through Gabalu Cave and applies this lens in depth when analyzing the art within. Images of horses, aurochs, bison, deer, and what Lewis Williams simply calls monsters. It also contains an upright animal-headed figure, I think a bison, but maybe a human body, often called a sorcerer, like the more famous examples of similar figures in other French caves, which I think is one of the monsters he's talking about. It's located at the very end of Gabalu, the deepest recess, which Lewis Williams thinks is notable. There's some other interesting art in that cave as well, some animals that aren't as common in Magdalenian French caves as those I just mentioned. Like there's a hare, there's this weird animal that looks like a dog but with a super long neck, so maybe that's another monster. And there's also a weasel that looks very silly. It doesn't exactly inspire awe like the rest of, or like some of the other cave art. It's this long-necked figure that looks like it's just popped up and is like, hey, how's it going, guys? Like, you know that meme about white people making that awkward smile when they pass you? There's a picture of a kid doing it with the caption, how white people smile at you when you pass them on the street. Anyways, you can Google it, it makes me laugh, but that's the exact face this weasel is making. Anyways, I said I wasn't going to talk about that cave too much, and look what I'm doing. One more cool thing about Gabalu is that it contains one of the few examples of a clothed human in Paleolithic art. This figure wearing a sort of parka, as best we can tell. Instead of just going over Lewis Williams' thoughts on these caves, which gets pretty into the weeds and really benefits from having visual aids and being as thorough as he is, which I don't want to do, instead let's have some fun and travel to another part of the world with a cave art tradition that we haven't covered yet, through the eyes of a very cool, adventurous writer, and let's see if we can apply Lewis Williams's shamanic lens to this rock art. And then we'll end by tying it all together and bringing in some stuff from past episodes to try to make what we see through the lens of Lewis Williams feel as alive as possible. So let's go to Norway. That writer is Robert McFarlane, who published his book Underland, A Deep Time Journey in 2019, a book that took him 10 years to write. It's what I'll describe as lyrical journalism, all about the underground in various contexts. He talks about the mycorrhizal networks of fungi that connects the individual plants of a forest. He talks about the catacombs underneath Paris. He talks about scientists who descend into the depths out of necessity to study ephemeral, elusive neutrinos. He talks about tombs made for nuclear waste and the difficulty in creating a message that would repel any curious being from, you know, indefinitely into the future. He talks about much, much more as well. It's a great book. You should definitely read it. Very well written. I'm just going to talk about one chapter in it, titled Red Dancers. In this chapter, McFarlane tells about traveling to Norway to see these red, human-like figures painted in a cave. They're very simply painted. They all look the same, like stick people drawings, essentially. Now, this doesn't sound too remarkable until you learn the details of the cave. It's one of the 12 caves on the west coast of Norway that have been found to contain ancient cave art, and they are literally on the coasts, like holes in the cliffs of fjords, open to gale winds and sea spray. Many were likely created by eons of pounding waves, creations hammered into being by Poseidon. Well, caves are kind of funny, kind of interesting. It's like they're like a thing that's created by an absence, kind of like a hole. There's a huge and very funny sounding philosophical debate about all this, like if holes exist or how they exist. We're definitely not going there, but you know, the point is these caves are on the rugged Norwegian coasts, and some can only be accessed by boat, including at the time that the images were made within. All are very remote, and not just in the way that means that there aren't any towns currently nearby, but perhaps there were towns a few thousand years ago when the painters entered the caves. No, these caves are in areas that can only be reached by very treacherous routes, whether by sea or by land. So it's quite unlikely that there would have been settlements to go along with them. McFarlane describes some of these caves, saying, quote, "These caves are unmistakably dramatic places. The Troll's Eye is a wave-smashed tunnel around 100 feet in diameter, running east-west wholly through the rock of a small island, in which the setting orange sun is framed once a year. Buckhammer Cave is set into a sea cliff so sheer that the mouth itself can be reached only from the water, a vault visible from the sea for miles in clear weather. Solsom Cave contains an overhanging panel of rock more than 100 square feet in area, on which is painted a monumental cruciform figure. In Fingal's Cave, the most southerly of the painted sites, at the point where the cave splits into two main passages and deepens away into the rock, stands a sharp menhir, the front face of which is struck by the sun's rays for a short time twice a year." Unquote. And the cave of the red figures that McFarlane is trying to reach is no different. The modern Norwegian name for the cave is Kolhellerin, which means hole of hell. It is perhaps the most remote of the 12 caves, at the tip of a 100-mile-long archipelago, on a coast with no current settlements. A striking feature lurks just beside it, in the water, sometimes awake, sometimes dormant, the whirlpool Moskstraumen, one of the strongest whirlpools in the world, occurring in unusually open water, not like a narrow strait like most whirlpools. It was the whirlpool that inspired Edgar Allan Poe's famous short story Descent into the Maelstrom, as well as the whirlpool in Jules Verne's A Thousand Leagues Under the Sea. But it has an even longer history in European fantasy and science. In the 17th and 18th centuries, knowledge of the maelstrom escaped the local region, and Europeans all over began writing very exaggerated, fantastical descriptions of it, even predominant early scientists and geographers. For example, the famous and insane 17th century polymath Athanasius Kircher argued that the maelstrom was evidence that the Norwegian Sea, the sea off the west coast of Norway, that the coast that faces like this vast stretch of Atlantic, and then in the very distance Greenland, he thought that that was connected to the Gulf of Bothnia, that sort of inlet between Sweden and Finland. So Kircher thought that the whirlpool was caused by like an underground tunnel that connected the two bodies of water, a tunnel that would have had to stretch hundreds of kilometers underground. But its history in the recorded collective mind goes back even further, to where science and fantasy merge together into myth. The word maelstrom, which English adopted from the Norse due to the interest in this specific whirlpool, is thought to have come from the Dutch word malen, which means to grind. And there are some old Norse poems from the 13th century that might explain why. These poems are the earliest known accounts of Moskstraumen, and they say that two magical millstones, these circular stones used for grinding grain, or in this case, salt, sank into the ocean on the northwest coast of Norway where Musk Strawman whirls today. However, since these millstones were magical, they kept spinning. They kept grinding salt, forever spinning underwater. So this is not only an explanation for the Musk Strawman maelstrom, but also for why seawater is salty. Pretty interesting. The old Norse word for maelstrom was different and much simpler. Havsflelg. Well, not simpler to pronounce. I'm gonna not try again, but it's a word that means ocean hole. As we continue, keep in mind our discussions of tunnels and vortices. Anyways, tunnels and vortexes in shamanic hallucinations, right? Maybe there's some sort of connection there. I don't know. So McFarlane, scoping out the site, took a look at that maelstrom and, you know, as you'd expect, kind of gulped and looked for another way to access the cave. By water is one of the two routes, luckily for him. Unluckily though, the other route is no less treacherous. This other way, the way McFarlane planned to go, is by foot, traveling over Lofoten Wall, a ridge of sheer cliffs and multiple mountain peaks. McFarlane arrived in the winter, when you have to be even more careful, since there are only a handful of passages that allow a way through. But McFarlane, rather than just shaking with nerves, he noticed something about these two routes. He says, quote, "Two entrance points to the underland, therefore, lie close by one another. A mouth of rock and a mouth of water, locked off by fierce mountains and fierce seas. The people who created the art of Kol Helleran more than 2,500 years ago took considerable risks just to reach the site of their making. Before even entering the cave space, they had to cross powerful landscape thresholds." Unquote. The day McFarlane was planning to leave solo for his modern-day vision quest was a day after many days of winter storms. The risk of avalanche had risen dramatically, and the retired Norwegian fisherman, whose house he was staying in, urges him not to go, then looks upon his determination to continue with a lot of bewilderment. The night before, McFarlane says, quote, "I cannot sleep. I open the curtains, stand by the window, and watch snowflakes rushing like fire sparks through the light of the last street lamp in the archipelago. It is an oddly peaceful sight, but I know it means the snow on the peaks and in the gullies will be building, and the avalanche risk will be growing." Unquote. Then, at dawn, he leaves the snow-silenced village. Once in the mountains, he needs to locate the passage he's aiming for. The only way through in the winter, a specific gully, one of many, that rises out of the lake that he's now circumnavigating. Quote, "Roosting on the lee crag of a rock island in the lake center is a colony of gulls. Their chatter and screams are comforting in that austere valley. The convivial sound of social life. Far ahead of me, black cloud hides the peaks, almost to their bases. This worries me. It will be hard to locate the correct gully. I have a strong sense of the terrain's disinterest, which I might at other times experience as exhilaration, but here, now, can feel only as menace." Unquote. He chooses what he thinks, what he prays, is the right gully, and describes the journey in gripping detail. The faith he must have in his ice axe as he climbs, how the clouds swallow the peaks, how he hears every so often the rumble of an avalanche or a rock fall. Quote, "Time slows, swirls, repeats. Each step is hard going, the heavy pack peeling me back off the slope, or jamming me into it. Spindrift hisses into my face, frets my cheeks. I murmur a mantra to myself, take the time that needs to be taken, take the time that needs to be taken. Why are you here? Why are you here? Ask the rocks and the wind in reply." Unquote. He reaches the top, but immediately encounters another problem. He falls through the snow until he's holding on with his arms and his legs are dangling. This is called a snow crevasse. He doesn't know how far down the space his legs are flailing in goes, and certainly doesn't want to find out. Luckily, after some struggling, he manages to climb back up. He says he floats himself free, which I like, and he finds that, yes, it was the correct gully. he is on the correct route, but the exposed ridge is even more treacherous. He slowly makes his way, taking the time that needs to be taken. After yet another physical ordeal, quote, I lie on my back, a gaffed fish, breathing heavily, and there above me, showing through the mist, is a sea eagle, low and circling, and the queasy fear in my throat is forgotten, and my heart leaps to be overflown by that remarkable bird in that remarkable place. Then I think, he's just sizing you up as lunch, and I laugh out loud at my stupidity and the land's indifference. My laughter up on the pass is whipped away by a wild westerly from which the wall had sheltered me during my ascent. Unquote. He continues, and eventually the clouds part for just a moment, and he can see the shore below, about 200 feet down. This is where he needs to go. Another while of clambering and ice picking, and he's on the shore, a wave-bashed shore. He must walk along for several miles to reach Col Helorin. Quote, headland after headland, until there at last, to the west, is the bay, and beyond it, perhaps, the vent of the cave. Green sea over white shell sand in the bay. Guard arms of rock curving out and around to either side. The bay water calm, though the outer ocean by the maelstrom is in chaos. Five sharp cones summits rising steep from the shore to the peak called Helsega, each higher than the last. From the top of each flows a white plume of cloud, bent flatter to the east, and there, set low in the belly of one, is the black vault of a cave. Lewis Williams's theory is meant to uncover diversity, not conceal it, remember? It's meant to be a theory that's simultaneously general, but also allows for novelty, for human creativity and schismogenesis, and for a variety of culture, art, and also cave topography. Not some static structure that humans are forever caged within. An important part of Lewis Williams's lens is what he calls activity areas. This is a way to allow for the topography of a given cave to play a role in how we today think about the images within. Every cave is different, and therefore the society that made the images within would have to accommodate these differences in how they thought about the cave, how they acted towards and within the cave, how they made images within the cave. Different cave shapes would make people use the caves in different ways. This is why Lewis Williams picks two caves from the same region with art from the same period to zoom in on. The activity areas of Lasso are much different than the ones in Gabalu. Gabalu Cave is a very narrow cave. It's a narrow tunnel that only allows for one person looking at any of the images, except for at the entrance, which is more spacious. This, combined with the fact that the monsters, like the sorcerer, are painted at the very end, makes Lewis Williams think that this was likely a cave for individual vision questers, rather than communal rituals. Lasso has a more complex topography, with more areas, activity areas, that allow for many people to gather, but also some side passages that are more narrow, so perhaps those were used for something like a vision quest, while the art in the more spacious chambers allowed for more collective rituals and activities to take place involving the figures on the walls. For Col Helorin and the other sea caves of Norway, we need to take the landscape into account too. It's unlikely that there were permanent settlements right outside the cave, like what might have been the case for Gabalu and Lasso. Instead, the journey to reach the cave was a big part of the making of the art within. The long, dangerous trek or row to the cave, that is an activity area itself. As McFarlane finished setting up camp inside of the cave, planning to venture into it the next day, he remarks, quote, in the Celtic Christian tradition, thin places are those sites in a landscape where the borders between worlds or epochs feels at their most fragile. Such locations were, for the peregrini, or wandering devouts, of circa AD 500 to 1000, often to be found on westerly headlands, islands, caves, coasts, and other brinks. This place, now, is one of the thinnest I have ever been. Unquote. And this was likely the point of the cave when they were painting it 2,500 years ago, to access thin places. The journey to the cave and the journey within it was so treacherous because it was likely a rite of passage. The archaeologist Hein Bjerk, who found a lot of these coastal cave art sites, thinks that the art was a ritual action, and the journey was a key part of it because it brought the Bronze Age person, quote, to the outer fringe of the human world, unquote, the thinnest places. Bjerk points out that many of the current names for the caves reference the underworld, like Kolhelerin, meaning hole of hell, but also one meaning hell's mouth. And then the other names evoke similar things, like lots of them mention churches. So it's kind of like a, you know, involving the religious practice that displaced the previous one. There's also another cave that translates to troll's eye. So, you know, other caves involve mythological figures. The archaeologist Richard Bradley talks about the nearby rock art of Sweden, perhaps part of a large culture area that includes the Norwegian art too, or influenced it. He says that the art is always at boundary locations, like obviously caves, where above ground and below ground mix, but also coasts and riverbanks, the boundary between water and land. He says these liminal places are where worlds come closest together. Bjerk adds to this, pointing out that all 12 caves on Norway's coast are passages into the earth, all except one with a dark zone at the end. There's one where the paintings are exposed to daylight, but the others, you know, this is another form of liminality, another border between light and dark, right at the border of sea and land. And since the cave painters and cave art viewers must go into the cave, maybe it's better to describe it not as a liminal or border area, but a zone of transition. Yes, it's a place where worlds meet, the ocean and the land, but to get to the art, you must go from the world of light into the world of dark. So maybe it's more of about transition than boundary. The dark zone is often where the paintings are, but in some caves, the paintings are right at the border between light and dark, the twilight zone. So there's a bit of a difference in the activity area where the images were made, depending on the cave. Many of the caves are just like a fairly straight passage into the earth, but Kolhelerin is cruciform, shaped like a cross. In other words, right when you enter the dark zone, you can keep going straight, but you can also go into two other passages that make the cave into a T shape or a cross. Some of the paintings are at the intersection, some are at the end of the straight passage. So again, a specific thing about this particular cave we have to keep in mind. There are multiple activity areas where the paintings are made. Of course, maybe it was conceptualized as a single activity area. That's another way they could have looked at it. But this is a sort of way to approach the caves that allows for diversity, but also generality. All the Norwegian caves share a same general structure. They go deep enough in to allow for a passage from light to dark, except that one. But there are differences between the specific caves that might be important in understanding them. Unfortunately, these Norwegian caves don't have the most complex topography or cave art, so you don't really get to see the power of thinking with these activity areas. We'll see how this thinking deals with complexity when we look at Lasso in future episodes. These caves are all more like Gabeloux, which is also a fairly straight chamber. The Norwegian caves often differ in a few ways. Some of these Norwegian caves are much larger. Some have ceilings that are very high up in parts. Others have entrances that are almost hidden, entrances you have to crawl through to enter the chamber filled with red human-like figures. Again, it's a balancing act between generalization and diversity. The anthropologist Clyde Cluckhone and psychologist Henry Murray once wrote that every man is like all other men, like some other men, like no other man. This is a quote I really like, and I'll translate that into modern language and read it again, because, you know, I think it's a good quote to keep in mind when talking about this balancing act. not just when it comes to humans, but when it comes to any category. Every person is like all other people, like some other people, and like no other person. If there were any phrase to have like a, to be like a motto for humanity, that's one that I might choose. It's a really good one to keep in mind. And, you know, along the same lines, every cave is like all other caves, like some other caves, and like no other cave. This quote works with pretty much any category. Sometimes the notable thing is the thing that the cave shares with other caves. Sometimes the notable thing is what sets it apart, what makes that cave, and no other cave. It's cool to think about, I think. There's another cool thing to think about, to go back to that term that I love, thin place. Think about the term thin place in relation to what we've been talking about this whole episode and last, shamanic cave art, and the idea that the cave wall is not a canvas, but a membrane between worlds. The next day, after a frigid, wet, wind-chilled night, McFarlane sets out towards the cave. He walks through the remains of a small town that existed there for a bit, and which I guess discounts the idea that it was impossible that an ancient settlement existed outside the cave. Just very unlikely, but not impossible. This was a town of 2 dozen people in 1900, 3 dozen in 1939, and 0 in 1950, when the government paid small isolated towns like these money to move elsewhere, closer to society. When it was around, though, the inhabitants lived off of fishing and their cows, which were sometimes hidden in Coal Hellerin during storms, and they could only reach broader society the two ways we've already discussed, by boat through the treacherous maelstrom, the mouth of the ocean, or by foot, the reverse of what McFarlane just did. As McFarlane walks through the ruins of the town, he remembers something the archaeologist Pora Petersdottir told him when they were talking in Oslo. Time isn't deep. It is always already all around us. The past ghosts us, lies all about us, less as layers, more as drift. Then he sees that, in fact, a family is still living in the town, a family of otters, which cheers him up and makes the land feel a little less foreboding. McFarlane walks the last few hundred steps towards the cave mouth, towards Hell's Mouth, quote, on ground falling sharp from cliffs to the sea, unquote. He reaches the mouth, quote, I pause at the threshold, look back and around, roar of waves on the far reefs, the distant churn of the maelstrom. A sea eagle turns overhead, wingtips near the cliffs that drop sheer to the water. The scale of the entrance is astounding. A 150-foot-high zon, the arc of the bay, the maw of the cave. This is an unmistakably performative space, a place for meaning-making. The cave is a slip rift, an entrance to darkness where time shifts, pauses, folds. A prickling in the shoulders as I cross the threshold. Unquote. As he walks deeper into the cave, the light gradually dims, color becomes shade, shadow becomes darkness. After 100 feet, McFarlane reaches the intersection that makes the cave a cross. Quote, I place a hand flat on the bastion and feel the cold rush fast up the arm. The air here thrums, sounded by sea and wind, driven into this hollow so that it turns upon itself. This space has been won by wave, by war. Unquote. In the cave, time is still very prominent in McFarlane's thoughts. It starts to swirl, gets all mixed up, starts to play by different rules. One reason for this is an observation of his that is kind of interesting. The deeper you get in the cave, the newer the cave is. He says that the space of the cave kind of reverses time, because, you know, you'd expect the deeper you go in, the older it would be, but that's not usually the case. and it isn't the case here. Every inch of the cave has been created by thousands of waves or drips, some other sort of erosion. The deeper you go, the newer the cave is. As he continues in the dark, in this space where time is all flipped around, he starts to feel connected to two other journeys into that same dark. First, the anonymous artists, thousands of years ago. He says, quote, "A summer's night, 3,000 years ago. At this latitude, in this season, darkness scarcely exists above ground. A small group of figures follows the shore, stepping from rock to rock. The cave's mouth is vast, and its lower lip sits close to the waterline. The figures pause at the threshold. The distant roar of the maelstrom. A sea eagle turns overhead, wingtips near the cliffs that drop sheer to the water. The figures pass one by one into the cave, and the world changes. Color thins out, yellow of the late sun ebbing. Green is gone, gray rises, gray of the rock, streaked with brown, streaked with red, wet sand underfoot. White of the sand, black of the deeper shadows ahead. Smell of damp stone. 100 feet into the cliff, and the last full light falls on a pale central buttress of rock, around which the cave space splits. It would be a good canvas, but it is too near to the outer world of waves and eagles, too near time told in its usual ways. The figures follow the teardrop rift, moving up between fallen stones. Here in the shadows, space and time spill into one another. If life exists, it is the slow life of rock. It is the sea's patient exploration of the mountains inside. Up where the tunnel wall overhangs them, the figures halt, make their preparations. Rock is to be the painter of rock. In a cup of stone, they crush hematite and mix it with spit, earth, and rainwater to make a red paste. The painting begins, dip of a fingertip, and a single sure red line moves across the pale slope of rock, curving down in an arc that echoes the chest and one leg of a figure that is dancing, a figure that is jumping. In the shifting light of a burning torch and the faint steady light of the distant summer sun, the figures on the rock seem here to move, to sway with the play of shadow and flame. These are presences made to exist in the dark, but also perhaps to survive it." Unquote. McFarlane reaches the end where the red figures are, or where they're supposed to be. As his eyes grow more and more accustomed to the dark, he gets less and less sure of himself. He still doesn't see them. He looks and looks, but he can't find these red dancers. Panic or doubt starts to creep up on him, whether from the dark of the cave or the dark of his mind. He starts to wonder if the red dancers were ever there at all. Now another journey into this same dark comes to his mind, ghosting him. The journey of that archaeologist, Hein Bjerk, in 1992. He was the one who discovered these red dancers. In 1992, nobody knew about them, but shell fragments had been found dating to 33,000 years ago nearby. So Bjerk and a friend were in a little dinghy exploring around. In McFarlane's mind, his journey, Bjerk's journey, and the journey of those ancient unknown people thousands of years ago all start to superimpose upon each other. As his eyes search in vain for these figures on the wall, Bjerk's journey comes to the forefront of his mind. He says, quote, "Smell of moss, smell of stone, pause at the threshold, roar of waves on far reefs, the distant churn of the maelstrom. A sea eagle turns overhead, wingtips near the cliffs that drop sheer to the water. The figures pass into the mouth of the cave, and the world changes. The cave twists into the cliff. Time reverses space. The deeper in they get, the younger the cave space. The journey into darkness is a journey to the present. The sea has taken thousands of years to win each yard of stone." Hein Bjerk tilts his head, and the light of his head torch falls upon the west wall of the cave, slips off it again. But what was that? Flicks up again, searches, settles, finds nothing, searches again, and there, is a faint red line, too firm and sure to have been authored by the rock itself, moving against the fall of the wall, too counter to gravity to be a deposit from runoff. And there is a cross piece to match it, cutting boldly through the first line. And suddenly there, shimmering out of the dark, is a red figure, a leaping red figure of a person, and another. The discovery, Bjork will say later, is like a shooting star, unexpected, undeserved, and magnificent. And it leaves him with a desperate longing to experience such a moment again, once more to be the first person in thousands of years to set eyes on these figures dancing in the dark. He begins years of travel up and down the western coasts, sailing and walking to cave after cave, an undertaking that moves from longing to addiction. He finds himself drawn both in his dreams and in his daily life into what he comes to call the cavescape. And he does find more figures, enough to feed his addiction. Red figures, always red, almost always the same simple form, leaping and dancing in the darkness of caves, up and down the coasts, familiar in their shape now and yet still utterly mysterious in their making. Each time he finds them, his heart leaps too, and there's a collapse of time, or a coexistence of multiple kinds of time, as the figures dance and flicker in the low light. Unquote. Right then, McFarlane too has his eyes catch upon something red. Finally, he starts to see the figures. One, then another, they all start to come quick. This is something you should remember for next episode, how it took him a really long time to see the figures in the caves. He says, quote, "Their red is rough at its edges, fading back into the rock that made it, blurred by water and condensation and all of these circumstances. The blur, the low light, my exhaustion, my blinks, are what give the figures their life, make them shift shapes on this volatile canvas in which shadow and water and rock and fatigue are all artists together." And for once, the old notion of ghosts seems new and true in this space. These figures are ghosts, all dancing together, and I'm a ghost too, and there is a conviviality to them, to us, to the thousands of years for which they have been dancing here together. Suddenly, unexpectedly, my head begins to tingle, and then my back and my chest start to shake, and I find myself crying, sobs shuddering my body in the teardrop-shaped rift, far from another human, and so close to these generous figures. The dangers of the journey to reach the dancers ebb from me. The joy of their movement ebbs into me, and I cry there, surprised and helpless, deep in granite and darkness, weeping for feelings I cannot name. Unquote. The Sami people, known best as semi-nomadic reindeer herders, but people who have lived in many other ways, fishing, fur trapping, sheep herding, live in northern Scandinavia, including Norway. The name Sami refers to a broad culture group, so there are like different cultures and traditions, different types of Sami under this umbrella of the Sami. The first thorough writings in the historical record on the Sami people was a text called Laponia by Johannes Schefferus, published in 1673. And the story of its publishing is quite interesting. Sweden and Germany, or I guess like Prussia at that time, were at war. And this text was funded by the Swedish monarchy because Germans kept claiming in pamphlets that Sweden had won its victories on the battlefield by means of Sami magic, which offended the Swedes. Even though the goal was to depict the Sami accurately, there were many inaccuracies, of course, but something that wasn't inaccurate was that the Sami did have magic. They lived in a cosmology that involved a form of shamanism. The Sami shamans are called Naodi, and they use ornately decorated drums in their practice. Ever since that first text was published, they have been a source of intrigue for the non-shamanic Europeans south of them. For example, before rich Europeans were going to ski resorts every winter, in 1767, Sami skiing was described by a missionary. "By a certain wooden machine of an oblong figure fastened to their feet, commonly called wooden sandals, they are carried with such rapidity over the highest mountains, through the steepest hills, that the winds whiz about their ears and their hair stands on end. Now, of course, their magic also intrigued the Europeans. But back to the Norwegian caves. In those Norwegian caves on the coast, 9 out of every 10 figures is one of those simple stick figures, like the ones McFarlane saw. But there are some other figures as well, which may provide more information. Bjerk describes these other figures, saying, quote, "For example, in Helvet, there is also a considerably larger figure, with antenna-like horns, outstretched arms with life-size hands, legs with knees, and feet with soles. Nearby is a painting of a single hand related to a field of red color that may represent a similar but more weathered figure. There are also zoomorphic figures and a few geometric figures, for example, long crossing lines in Salsamhula and the around 20 meter long horizontal line in Helvet. There are no stickmen in Skaren Monsen, where a long horned animal is accompanied by 4 indeterminate figures. This cave also contains the only carved rock art recorded in the Norwegian caves, a halo without traces of paint on a large rock in the cave's outer part exposed to natural light." Unquote. That figure he first mentioned, the larger figure with horns, is interpreted by some to be a person wearing ceremonial headgear, typical in Sami practices. Some suggest a connection, that the painters also believed in a 3-tiered cosmos, like the Sami, or perhaps were Sami themselves. McFarlane says, quote, "The presence in the painted caves of at least one figure wearing ceremonial headgear suggests possible relation with the 3-tiered Sami cosmos, whereby the universe is arranged vertically into 3 layers, the sky, the earth, and the underworld. Only shamans and the dead are able to pass between the tiers by means of an axis mundi that, in the form of a river or tree, connects the upper and lower spirit realms to the living present of the middle realm. The paintings and petroglyphs of these extreme landscapes may also be understood as an early form of land art, whereby the specific place of making, the cave interior itself, is chosen not for the pragmatic purposes of shelter and preservation, but also as part of a potent, larger location that extends in radiating context, both outwards to the cliff, bay, and coastline that contain it, and inwards to the implied further depths, metaphysical and actual, of the cave's interior. In the case of Carl Hellerin, certainly, it is hard to imagine that the cave closeness to Mockstrammen Maelstrom was not considered part of its power as a place of making." Unquote. But Bjerk thinks that maybe the repeated figures might be just as explanatory as the outliers. He builds upon others who point out that the liminality, the borders between sea and land, above ground and underground, light and dark, could be resonant with the prehistoric activities that took place there. Perhaps the caves were involved in rites of passage. Perhaps they were a key aspect in that culture of boys becoming men and girls becoming women. Like the hero's journey, if any of you are fans of Joseph Campbell, you travel outside of society, you travel to an extremity, maybe where the world is thinnest, and you come back to what you have known, but you see it in a new light. Everything has a new vibrancy after the experience in the cave dark. When McFarlane comes out of the cave, he kind of has a similar experience. He says, quote, "I stop on the threshold of the cave, stepping out of the rock and into air. The rain is heavier now. The landscape comes back to itself, first brightness, then color, surge of water, echo of wave in the cave space behind me. I pick my way back along the bay line towards the remains of the settlement. What did I see in the dark? A shadow play of pasts, events refusing sequence, the fingertip drawing its lines through time far from the well-lit world, there in the unfathomable cave. This was a place that absorbed those visitors who crossed its threshold, as it had absorbed me, another in the long history of meaning seekers and meaning makers in its shadows. The sea eagle gyres by the cliff, the waves crash on the boulders below the cave, the maelstrom spins and unspins. Time proceeds according to its usual rhythms beyond the threshold, but not there, in that thin place." unquote. Bjork, thinking specifically about rites of passage, zooms in on this feeling that you get when you exit the cave after spending an emotional time within. He says, quote, "However, the most profound embodied experience is perhaps when you re-enter life and the light outside. Your reset senses are suddenly bombarded by all the ordinary things that filled them in your brain to a degree that borders on invisibility prior to the time spent in the dark void. It is a strange feeling to be surprised by all normal things, the lazy sound of bumblebees, the smell of the sea and bird excrement, grass and flowers, the warmth of a summer's day, the abundance of movement and color, swarms of insects against the bright red and yellow flowers that nod in the wind, and the blinking reflection of sunlight from the surface of the deep blue sea, the living everyday things we always see but hardly notice. Caves are a physical separation, a place to be away from everything else. They have qualities which can symbolize contrast-filled stages of rites of passage, places out of life and time, without movements, colors, weather, scents, and sounds. These are places where it is easy to imagine physical and mental ordeals. With simple arrangements, ordeals may easily be increased to levels of sheer horror, bodily and spiritual stress which are likely to enhance the importance of the post-liminal status and provide a sweet feeling of self-esteem and pride. I will also stress the emotional and symbolic value of the return to the outside world after a lengthy stay in the cave's embrace, with a reset and highly receptive senses bombarded by movements, scents, colors, contours, sounds, a cacophony of life that can enhance a feeling of being new in the world in the finale of that separation, transformation, incorporation sequence. Thus, caves are a perfect place to emerge from, to re-enter the world with a new status." Unquote. So it's really interesting. Caves might have been like a natural sensory deprivation chamber. Those are really big now, I think, and you know, it's cool to imagine ancient people doing that. The whole point is emerging from the cave after your senses have been deprived. But this isn't the only reason that Bjork likes this interpretation. He adds one more reason, saying, quote, "There's yet another aspect that may hint at a relation to rites of passage, especially rituals related to the child-adult transition. The liminal phase often implies deprivation, stripping people who undergo such rituals of property or social positions. In short, they are all alike, naked, regardless of their former roles or status. Thus, the strikingly simple and uniform appearance of stickmen in the caves, from Lika to Lofoten, may well symbolize a ritual, quote-unquote, undressing and homogenizing of participants in initiation rites," unquote. So, I think that's a really cool idea, and I don't think it has to contradict the shamanistic explanation. I think, like, you know, the culture could have had a shaman involved in these coming-of-age rituals, or the rituals and shamanism could have coexisted in other ways. Bjork mentions one more thing about caves that I've never thought about before. Earlier, I read that passage from McFarlane, where he was talking about these caves of Norway and saying that maybe the broader landscape was very much involved in the choosing of those particular sites. And he said that one line. He said that maybe the caves weren't chosen just for the pragmatic purposes of shelter and preservation, but also as part of a potent, larger location that extends in radiating context both outwards to the cliff, bay, and coastline that contain it, and inwards to the implied further depths, metaphysical and actual, of the cave's interior. Now, Bjork kind of adds to this something interesting. He says, quote, "As you penetrate the darkness of the cave, you encounter branches leading upwards, downwards, to the side, or beneath gigantic rocks. Regardless of which route you choose to follow, you eventually reach a point where you cannot go any further. Yet, at the same time, you observe that these points are not the cave's end. It's just too cramped for us humans to be able to press further in. A child could squeeze a little further, but even the smallest child would probably shortly reach a point where the physical entrance of the cave would set a limit, at least for humans. Thus, caves are not confined spaces. It is the human body which restricts how far we can go, not the cave. Within lies the never-ending dark, and all that belongs to it. Here the night hides when the day rules, and from here the darkness and stillness seep out when the sun sets. Such chambers do not have a definite, observable termination. On the contrary, further connections may be observed in the form of innumerable openings, which eventually become so narrow that it is impossible for humans to proceed. An osmotic membrane which allows some beings to pass through, while others, humans, cannot. This adds further support to the sense of connection to places that people cannot normally reach. Unquote. One reason that there's less rock art the further north you go in Europe is because when people were painting the caves in Spain and France, the caves up north were encased in glaciers. And even when the glaciers slowly receded, there remained another factor, the lack of limestone, the rock where the majority of cave art in Spain and France lies upon. A rock that often provides a natural varnish of sorts of calcium carbonate that gives the art a much longer life. When you look at the caves in France and Spain, there are some interesting features that the Norwegian caves lack. It's interesting. Bjerk's analysis of the Norwegian caves emphasizes how the cave provides a sort of near-death experience. He says that the power of the cave, and a big reason why it was used for transitional rituals, is because in the cave, light, color, sound, smell, movement, and therefore time, life, they're all abolished. This obviously makes sense, unless you incorporate Paleolithic lamps. All of a sudden, all these things return, but in a new way, right? Flickering, red-shifted, as we've talked about. So maybe, when looking at a cave with ancient cave art within, we should ask, were the ancient people who visited this cave seeking a temporary death? Or a foreign life. Cosquer Cave near Marseille, France, was discovered in 1991 when three divers died there. These days, the cave is only accessible by water through a 360-foot-long underwater chamber. But if you manage to make it all the way, you are rewarded by first air, then by a wide chamber containing tons of cave art from 25,000 to 17,000 years ago. It contains more than 150 animal figures, seals, ibexes, goats, deer, the extinct seabird called an auk, horses, felines, but I'm bringing it up because it also contains another common feature of cave art in many parts of the world that we haven't talked about yet. These things called finger flutings, marks where people touched and dragged their fingers or some sharp object along the cave walls as they walked. Finger flutings are only possible when the cave walls are made of a softer material, like clay or mud, so not something they could have done in those Norwegian caves. Some finger flutings are so high up that they must have built some sort of ladder or platform or something. In Cosquer Cave, the finger flutings are so ubiquitous that they form the background for the representational images. In another French cave, Peche Merle, Michel Lorblanchet measured these finger flutings and found that there were 1,290 square feet of them, or 120 square meters. Do finger flutings have something to do with Lewis Williams's idea that prehistoric cave painters understood the cave wall as a membrane? Separating worlds? Was this a practice that activated or connected someone to those other realms? How else could we explain their ubiquity? Another common feature of cave art that might be related to the wall as membrane idea are handprints, either painted by placing one's hand in paint and then on the wall, or by placing one's hand on the wall and then blowing paint onto it, creating what's called a negative handprint. Michel Lorblanchet, that researcher we talked about in episode 3.2, did anthropological field work in Australia, living with Aboriginal Australians who used blow painting techniques for their art, generally, not just handprints. When Lorblanchet was back in France, he tried to recreate the famous Spotted Horses painting of Lasso using only blow painting, and he succeeded, almost poisoning himself with manganese dioxide in the process. So Lorblanchet thinks that blow painting might have been a more widespread technique in cave art than most researchers think. He also has opinions on finger flutings. Lorblanchet concluded that finger flutings were involved in creation, in, quote, bringing forth creatures from the void and the inextricable, unquote. But Lewis Williams criticizes this, saying that Lorblanchet is viewing the finger flutings in terms of the accompanying representational images. In other words, he's falling victim to the mimetic curse. He's placing the representational images at the top of a hierarchy and seeing the finger flutings and their meaning in terms of the representational images. They are made to bring forth the animals into our world. But maybe, Lewis Williams wonders, the finger flutings had meaning independently. Lewis Williams also avoids the mimetic curse regarding the handprints. He makes a very interesting observation. Cave art researchers, by and large, have been interested in the image of the handprint, and not the act of making it. Lewis Williams says, hey, wait a second, maybe the act of touching the cave and the act of leaving your handmark was more important than just the persisting image. Lewis Williams wonders if blow painting might have been a revered activity, at least when it comes to handprints, found in many different cave art traditions throughout the world. This is bolstered by the fact that human breath has widespread spiritual significance. Imagine how you'd interpret breath and air and wind without this framework of scientific materialism and secularism. Wind and air are invisible, yet you feel them. And consuming them and releasing them, wind or air, inhaling and exhaling, that's the constant ebb and flow that keeps you alive. Like, this is another thing like dreams. It's just crazy to try to imagine what you'd make of it if you weren't, you know, told these things that took centuries to figure out. And a quick look around the world at some different traditions really shows that the air and the wind and breath, these were all very important things for a lot of cultures. Like, first of all, the words psyche, spirit, animal, and animate all come from ancient Greek roots that also meant wind, air, breath. Owen Barfield says, quote, such a purely material content as wind and such a purely abstract content as the principle of life within man or animal are both late arrivals in human consciousness. Their abstractness and their simplicity are alike evidence of long ages of intellectual evolution. So far from the psychic meaning of spiritus having arisen because someone had the idea, principle of life, and wanted a word for it, the abstract idea, principle of life, is itself a product of the old concrete meaning of spiritus, which contained within itself the germs of both later significations. We must, therefore, imagine a time when spiritus, or pneuma, or older words from which these had descended, meant neither breath, nor wind, nor spirit, nor yet all those three things, but when they simply had their own peculiar meaning, which has since, in the course of the evolution of consciousness, crystallized into the three meanings specified. Unquote. So, he's saying that in a little bit of a wordy way, but what Barfield is saying here is that wind, breath, and spirit all meant the same thing at one point. And, you know, I'm sure there's cultural differences and stuff, but looking around the world really shows that this was fairly common. Like the ancient Hebrew word, ruach, or something like that, means both spirit and wind. And it's interesting to read the first line of the Hebrew Bible with that in mind, right? When God began to create heaven and earth, the earth being unformed and void, with darkness over the surface of the deep, and a wind, ruach, from God sweeping over the water, right? A wind from God sweeping over the water. It's interesting language there. And then a few pages later in Genesis, God breathes life into Adam. So, you know, wind and breath are all related to God here. And across the Mediterranean, the Pythagoreans understood the void that exists outside of the universe, the seed that would millennia later become the neutral, infinite container space of Newton. The Pythagoreans understood that void to be a sort of heavenly breath. And the Greek philosopher Anaximenes said, quote, "As the psyche, being air, holds a man together and gives him life, so breath and air hold together the entire universe and give it life," unquote. And we can look at other cultures. In Danish, spirit and breath is the same word. Something like I don't know how to pronounce the weird circle over the A, but that's what some Danish guy told me, so I trust him. And going to another continent, the Creek Indians of the southeast U.S. have a creator god called Hesakatamisi, translated as the master of breath, responsible for wind and other weather, as well as being deeply tied to creation. And the Lakota have a being or part of a being called enveloping sky, visible only as the blue part of the sky, but present everywhere and responsible for the existence of all motion, life, consciousness. Spirit and life are intimately connected to breath and wind for the Lakota. Wind comes out of the enveloping sky, often spreading the enveloping sky's messages. The Lakota have a much more complicated understanding of wind, I should note. They split it into four winds, coming from the four cardinal directions, north, east, south, west. And something really interesting is that one of the functions of the peace pipes, used in their traditional ceremonies, is to make this wind slash breath slash spirit visible. Right? You can see the wind in the smoke that you exhale. Really, really interesting to me. Next time you blow a vape smoke cloud, or whatever you do, I recommend trying to see things in the cloud, like you do if you're lying down on a picnic blanket looking at the sky. It's really cool to imagine, if you believe that the wind and the air was alive, like how you'd interpret the sort of diaphanous smoke that you exhale. One more culture, the Diné or the Navajo in the southwestern U.S., they have a concept of holy wind, Nilchi, that means air, wind, and atmosphere, but it isn't just those terms as scientific materialism understands them, but as something that's necessary for life, movement, speech, awareness, communication between all things. They believe we have an internal wind, misunderstood as a belief in the soul by Europeans for a long time. A Navajo elder, I couldn't find the name, was quoted as saying, quote, "Wind existed first as a person, and when the earth began its existence, wind took care of it. We started existing where darknesses lying on one another occurred. Here the one that had lain on top became dawn, whitening across. What used to be lying on one another back then, this is wind. It, wind, was darkness. That is why when darkness settles over you at night, it breezes beautifully. It is this, it is a person, they say. From there, when it dawns beautifully, becoming white streaked through the dawn, it usually breezes. Wind existed beautifully, they say. Back there in the underworlds, this was a person, it seems." unquote. So maybe breath painting, blow painting, had some deep significance in at least some of the prehistoric cave painting cultures. We can combine all of these thoughts with other things that we've talked about. Think back to the first episode in this series about Paleolithic proto-animation driven by the flickering firelight. Lewis Williams brings this into his theory a little, saying that in the dim, flickering light, these aspects of the rock wall might look like animal parts before any paint was put on. So maybe the flickering, dynamic, dim light was used to sort of inculcate visions that involved the rock wall that then became paintings. Or maybe it was for people to try to find in the moving, uneven wall something that reminded them of their recent vision quest. Or maybe it was the vision quest. Lewis Williams also points out many examples from Spain and France that show, instead of the classic cave art image of an animal viewed from its side, the animal is combined with the particularities of the rock wall to make it seem like the animal is looking out of the wall, or, in one case, trapped in the wall. Quote, "The figures are not merely painted onto the surface. They become part of the cave itself, part of the nether realm. In their various stages of altered states, questers sought, by sight and touch, in the folds and cracks of the rock face, visions of powerful animals. It is as if the rock were a living membrane between those who ventured in and one of the lowest levels of the tiered cosmos. Behind the membrane lay a realm inhabited by spirit animals and spirits themselves, and the passages and chambers of the caves penetrated deep into that realm." Unquote. Right? When you Google cave art, images of an animal's side profile come up because those are the easiest to see in a photo. But there are also examples like this, kind of hard to see in photography, where the animal is staring out at you, or even coming out at you. Often, these head-on images use cracks or holes in the cave wall, and Lewis Williams thinks that that might be important, might be further evidence that cave walls were seen as permeable membranes separating our world from other worlds, the worlds of spirits and shamans and dreams. To this, we can also add that musical instruments have been found in caves, flutes and bull roarers. Drumming and chanting is often used in traditional trances worldwide, and there's been lots of studies looking at the acoustics of specific caves and how it relates to the cave art within. Lewis Williams paints a picture of caves as a site of a foreign form of life, not a temporary death like Björk. But again, we should respect diversity, and not let the generalizing impulse smooth over interesting divergences. Right? Different cultures can use caves differently, different people can use different caves differently. But I'm not sure if Lewis Williams' lens applies completely to the Norwegian caves. I don't think it quite lines up. Anyways, to wrap up this episode, I'll read a bit more from him, some quotes that can serve as a summary of his theory of the origin of the cave art, at least the cave art of France and Spain. And maybe you can see why I don't know if it applies that well to the Norwegian caves. Anyways, Lewis Williams says, quote, "Images were not so much taken underground. Pictures of the world above lodged in people's memories and placed there. They were both obtained and fixed there. The hallucinatory or spirit world together with its painted and engraved imagery was thus invested with materiality and precisely situated cosmologically. It was not something that existed merely in people's thoughts and minds. The spiritual nether world was there, tangible and material, and some people could empirically verify it by entering the caves and seeing for themselves the fixed visions of the spirit animals that empower the shamans of the community, and also by experiencing visions, perhaps even in those underground spaces." Unquote. Elsewhere, Lewis Williams calls prehistoric caves of Spain and France the entrails of the nether world, which I really love. And Lewis Williams, despite his more normie, evo-psych, scientific materialist approach, he kind of sounds like Deleuze and Guattari and Ambrose when he says, quote, "We have seen that paint should not be regarded as a purely technical substance. It probably had its own significance and potency. Perhaps it was a kind of power-impregnated solvent that dissolved the rock and facilitated intimate contact with the realm behind it. The images were not so much painted onto rock walls as released from or coaxed through the living membrane that existed between the image maker and the spirit world," unquote. Elsewhere, again, he sounds like them, saying, quote, "Image making did not merely take place in the spirit world. It also shaped and incrementally created that world. Every image made hidden presences visible. There was thus a fecund interaction between the given topography of the caves, mercurial mental imagery, and image fixing by individuals and groups. Through time, the images built up and modified the spirit world both materially in the caves and conceptually in people's minds. The spirit world, like the social world above, was to some degree malleable. People could engage with it and to a certain extent shape it. In most cases, this shaping took the form of adding new images to those already there, or starting to create a new panel altogether. But in some rare cases, there seem to have been attempts at removing images already there. In these instances, the sought-after animal was not simply discovered in the convolutions of the rock. It was created by the human intervention and an interaction between two elements, light and darkness, leaving the world of light and entering the dark, subterranean realm. The image maker, or makers, carried a lamp or torch. This flickering flame was something that questers had to master, and which, evidence suggests, they used for further revelations. An important reciprocality is implied by these images born of light and shadow. On the one hand, the creator of the image holds it in his or her power. A movement of the light source can cause the image to appear out of the murk. Another movement causes it to disappear. The creator controls the image. On the other hand, the image holds its creator in its power. If the creator or subsequent viewer wishes the image to remain visible, he or she is obliged to maintain a posture that keeps the light source in a specific position. If the viewer tires and, as a result, lowers the light, the image seems to retreat into the realm behind the membrane. Perhaps more than any other Upper Paleolithic images, these creatures, creations, of light and darkness point to a complex interaction between person and spirit, artist and image, viewer and image. There is a great deal more to Upper Paleolithic cave paintings than pictures simply to be looked at. Some of the images sprang from a fundamental metaphor." Unquote. And I'll see you next time.